What's up, everybody? Jeff, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jeff.
I promise I'm gonna try not to cuss. Part of my vernacular, so if I slips out, I'm gonna be on my best behavior. My sobriety date is January 21st, 2023. If you guys are like me, you probably sit out there and do the math. That's 2 years, 6 months, 18 days that I haven't had the need to take a drink. My home group is New Frontier Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, Baby Boulevard in Norfolk, Virginia, the Ocean View section. We meet Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. Sundays at 5:30, there's a group called United We Stand. It's the same group, meets in the same church, same people. Two different group names on the meeting app, but it's the same group, so we meet twice a week. Before I come here, I spoke Saturday night at the Tidewater Late Night Zoom group. And you get like 20 or 30 minutes there, so you get like 40 minutes, 50 minutes here. So I kind of ran through it really quick Saturday night, and I left out so many things that I wanted to say. So I sat down yesterday, and I got my notebook out, and I was just going to make some bullet points, and I was going to bring it up here. And I'm a sponsor, and everybody told me, don't do that. Just say a prayer, get up here, and go. And I started writing because I wanted to qualify. I wanted to tell you guys who I was and where I was from and how much I drank and the terrible things I did. And I got like 5 pages into this terrible drunkalogue, and I was nowhere near getting sober. It was horrible. It was like an affirmation of the first step all over again. I was like, look at my life. When I drink, it gets rough. It is terrible. I'm one of them low bottom alcoholics. Incarceration, wrecked vehicles, injuries, very, very nasty things happened in my life. I was born and raised in Ocean View, born in DePaul Hospital in 1983. I don't know, I'm trying to keep it on alcohol. My mom told me when I was young and when I was teething, she used to rub whiskey on our gums when we were teething. So I think I might have been using alcohol as a coping mechanism as an infant. I remember going on the bay with my dad fishing when I was young. And I would see him take his Budweiser bottles and bloop, 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 and like sink them. Because it's okay to drink on the boat. You just had to sink the bottles in case the Coast Guard or the Marine Police pull up or something so they don't find all the empty cans. So it was okay to drink from a young age. Just don't get caught. These are kind of the things I was taught as I was young. A lot of people get up here and they talk about that first drink and how it made them feel. I do not remember my first drink. I've scoured my memory and my mind. I don't remember my first drink at all. I know about the time that I started getting drunk because my best friend when I was young was 2 years older than me. So when he was 16 years old and he had his car, it was a 1987 Chevrolet Celebrity, and we painted it primer gray. And so if he's 16, I'd have been 14. Now we're going and we're doing what we call shoulder tapping. We were getting older guys in the parking lot. Hey, we got $20. We want you to buy us a case of beer and you can keep your change. And get us a pack of Philly blunts so we can roll something up too. And so me and him and our other buddy, it was three of us, and we'd get a 12-pack of natural ice. So if you do the math, 12 divided by 3, that's 4 beers apiece. I would get 6, and the two of them would get 3. I hated the taste of it, but I liked the way it made me feel. Immediately, I was taking more than my share, and I loved the way it made me feel immediately. This is 14 years old. 15 years old, you're able to work in Virginia at the time as long as your hours were low. I was making like $5.15 an hour flipping burgers at Wendy's and putting chicken nuggets in the grease. You work a 4-hour shift, you got burn marks all up and down your arms, and you made $20 minus taxes. It was terrible. Then I found out that you could get some weed and then buy it high and sell it low. And this became my way of making an income. And I got pretty good at it pretty quick. This is 15 years old. I'm still not even 16 to get my license yet. So we're drinking and selling pot at 15 years old. I go to 7-Eleven, get a Mad Dog 2020. stick it in my backpack, take the two zippers on the JanSport, and come up like this with the straw out the top, selling dime bags in the lunchroom. This was me sophomore, junior year of high school. Turned 16, got the car. I specifically remember a time when I was driving down Thole Street. And not Thole Street. Granby Street, over there off where it turns into Llewellyn. Anyway, there's a one-way street. And I remember coming out of a blackout at 16 years old. Coming out of a blackout, going the wrong way on a one-way. Two people in the back seat, one person in the side, my buddy Nick. And he's shaking me like, Jeff, wake up. And I just come to and there's headlights coming on. And that was when I had my first vehicle in the first couple months. So now I'm selling dope and I'm blacking out, driving the wrong way on a one-way at 16 years old. The Ocean View Shopping Center, you could always find somebody that would go to the liquor store for you. If you paid them a couple extra dollars, a half a gallon of Aristocrat vodka was like $9. I'd give them $20 and keep the other 11, bring me the vodka. So we were partying hard. Despite all that, I managed to keep straight A's. I was taking AP classes, AP Physics, AP Calculus, AP English. Graduated high school, 17 years old, with 3 college credits my senior year. Got invited to ODU to take a scholarship. There was a scholarship competition they had going on. They invited 500 kids from the state of Virginia. You had to do a writing prompt and a math test. Well, I had taken college placements. It was 1480 on my SATs in my junior year. Didn't even take it senior year. I showed up to ODU and I was just dressed just like I am today. All the rest of the kids were suits and stuff, had their parents with them. I just showed up, took the test. 3 kids out of the 500 got the scholarship. I was one of them. So when I go to college, am I showing up as a student who's there to study with this full paid scholarship and take advantage of these opportunities? Or did I roll straight into my freshman year, found the parties where the sorority brothers, where the fraternity brothers was doing keg stands and sell them some weed? I went straight to the party. School was too easy. I could not show up and still make grades that would pass. So I was partying and having a good old time. I had a girlfriend at the time. She went to Granby with me. She was a year behind me. When she graduated, she came. I was mechanical engineering. She was civil engineering. We got an apartment on campus. Her mom, I think, paid most of the bills on campus. I'm not quite sure. It was a blur back then. So when you're living in college and you got a little extra money in your pocket from all these extracurricular activities I was doing, school's too easy. Nobody's looking now because I'm like 19, 20 years old. In my eyes, I was a grown man and I was drinking heavy. 40s of Old English was my favorite thing, like 2 a day, just on a regular day. I started getting like, I think it was E&J at the time. I've had pretty much a romance with every brand and type of liquor throughout my life, 4 or 5 years with each one of them. But at that time it was brandy. It was Paul Masson, E&J, whatever you could, things like that. So what is it, 2003? Y'all remember a storm called Hurricane Isabel? All right, so 2003, Hurricane Isabel hits. And I'm on campus when Hurricane Isabel hits, and we go 2 weeks without power. The lights are shut off. There's trees in the middle of the street, generators running everywhere. It was complete pandemonium, but all those college kids still wanted to party. I remember me and my buddy Dave, the same one that was 16 when I was 14, we set up like an underground boxing league. We bought some gloves and we were in the backyard fighting with each other, and everybody was taking turns and drinking E&J out of the bottle by the neck. And we were fighting each other. And I thought because the trees were down and the power was out and nothing was going on, the hurricane had shut everything down, that the police just weren't gonna come. I was totally wrong about that. They came. And I was standing there with the boxing gloves on, bleeding out my face. The backpack that had my pistol in it, because I was carrying a pistol with the drugs that I was selling, was over there. And I was over here. And everybody freeze. And I was gonna run, but I knew I was too drunk to run. There was a tree that was over a privacy fence. I was gonna run up the tree and over the fence. In my mind, it was all worked out, but I had the sense enough to know that I was way too drunk. I wasn't going to make it. The other 30 people that were at the party were going to rat me out when they found what was in that backpack. So I took the hit. And I look back at it now, 42 years old, and I go, man, that was my first bottom. That was my first terrible, terrible bottom. That alcohol had taken me from a kid with a scholarship to college and a good opportunity in front of me in the engineering school. I had 89 credits, pretty close to graduating, to being incarcerated, convicted felon. All my rights were stripped away from me, and you know, that was my first real major hit that I took with alcohol. So the incarceration's over with. 5 years parole, got to go to work now. So I'm working whatever odd jobs I can. I'm hanging drywall, I'm doing electrical, pulling wires, doing anything I can to try to make the ends meet. Now I'm in my early 20s. And I become that guy who's at work all day, comes with the dust from mixing up mortar and putting bricks all day, just going to the bar to get drunk after work because he's covered in sweat and dust from working all day. So now I'm the guy who's sitting on the bar stool, and I'm angry now because I know I blew these opportunities. I'm fostering resentments and I don't even know it. And I'm angry. And the bar stool becomes a way of life. And then I'm 26 years old, I'm sitting on a bar stool, I meet a woman. We date for a while. Very tumultuous relationship. She worked at a place called Clancy's. I don't know if y'all know what that is, but she was a dancer at Clancy's. And we date for about 6 months, and then she says, Jeff, I'm pregnant. So, okay. Life's been kind of hard up to this point, mostly at my own hand. But I'm going to try to do the right thing. I'm going to be a father. I'm going to cut back on the drinking. I know it's a problem. I had a good dad. He drank a lot, but he was a good dad, so I'm going to be a good dad. We go through the pregnancy. The baby's born. I cut the umbilical cord. He's Jeff Jr. And then 2 years go by. We start arguing a lot. She says she's going to take the baby and go live with her dad. I said, you're not going to do that. That's my son. You're not going to do that. One thing leads to another. We get a DNA test done. Comes back 0.0%, not the father to begin with. So now, I decide, again, I'm angry. Life ain't treating me right. It's everybody else's fault. I have, and her and the baby are gone. So now I got the self-pity, and I got a good reason to get drunk the way that I want to. This is when I start getting into vodka. The vodka tend to make me, like, violent. Made me kind of not right in the head when I drink vodka. And back to the bar stool. Leave the bar, driving home, don't remember anything. Wake up with the police at my driver's side window. I hit a dumpster. The dumpster slid off the landing, hit the apartment building, and I was asleep with the car still running. I blew a .24 that night. And got charged with a DUI, got bond, got out. They could never prove that I was on the city streets because the dumpster that I hit was in my apartment complex. And there's a thing called the implied consent law. If they can't prove you were on city streets, you were on private property, the BAC gets thrown out. Still got first offense DUI, but didn't get the enhancement. But I tell you all that because now I'm showing you where my bottoms are at when I'm drinking. This is where the judge says, take this paper and go get 5 signatures. I get my introduction to AA. I come in here and I meet you fine people. I go to a place called Easy Does It Service Center in Norfolk. There are 3 meetings over there. I go to a place called the Unity Group on Tuesday night. I met a man named Bill McLean who gave me my first white chip. This is 2010. And then I go to a place called the Bayview Group on Granby Street, Talbot Park, Baptist Church, Saturday night at 8 o'clock. I saw people in there getting chips for 5 years. I said, 5 years? You got it beat. What are you still here for? Once I got the 5 signatures, though, I was off and running again. At the Easy Does It, I had a 40-ounce Old English under the passenger seat of the car that I had just got out of the impound from my DUI. So I'm going to the AA meeting to get my paper signed with a 40 under my passenger seat. Car just got out of the impound, but I don't have a problem. I'm not like you guys. I don't have a problem. You guys are alcoholics. They were like, oh, I warmed my hands over the burn barrel in Chicago with a pint of that. Freezing cold in Chicago on a burn barrel. It's rough, buddy. I just had a bad night. I just kind of crashed my car a little bit. I'm glad I'm not like these people. I got out of there and I kept drinking. You read the first step in the 12 and 12, and it says, it's got this description of how they can save the potential alcoholic the next 10 or 15 years of literal hell. In the first 11, 12, and 12. And I related that so much because between 2010 and 2023, there was 13 years there, that was literal hell. I mean, I was 26 years old. I was a potential alcoholic. I mean, I was an alcoholic, but man, by the time I was 39 years old and I got my second DUI, it was horrible. More bad relationships. I got smart enough not to drink and drive, so I would walk home from the bar. Now I'm walking home from the bar, they pull me over, they give me public intoxication. I'm mad at the cops. I said, man, I can't walk, I can't drink and drive, I can't walk and drive. What y'all even sell me the liquor for? Assault charge in a bar fight. Going to jail. Drunk tank. Angry Jeff going to jail because he drinks too much. Can't see the pattern yet. Abusive relationships. I like to pick the women that had the drug and alcohol problems too. Made it easier to hide what was wrong with me. She's mad because I drink too much whiskey on a Saturday, but she's got a mimosa Sunday morning, so how can you say anything to me? 2023, I was leaving work. My dad had retired after 35 years, CHKD, and we were having a retirement party for him. Now at this point, I got two bottles. I got one that I'm gonna take with me to the party, and I got another one I keep in the car so I can, when I go home, because that first bottle and that whole party, that's just getting me started. I'm gonna go home and get real drunk. Dad's retirement party, shots of Crown Royal, shots of Jim Beam. I only live a mile away from my parents. I'm driving home, I gotta cross one main road to get there. It's like from here to that road out there, I can see my house, and as I'm coming across the road, I didn't get T-boned. I'm supposed to yield the right of way when I'm going across the main road. The other guy had the right of way. It was the most violent hit that I've ever taken in my life. They said he was going 55 and a 35. I failed to yield the right of way. He was speeding. It was a violent, violent car accident. There was serious injuries all around. Fire trucks, police, ambulance, the stretchers come out. I go to hospital, other driver goes to hospital. I know we're recording, I don't want to say too much. I believe that most of it's behind me. And when I'm in that hospital, the police handcuff me to the stretcher, and the nurse is scared. They put like the Hannibal Lecter mask on me. And they're wheeling me through the hospital. And I hear the doctors and the police arguing over who was going to get custody of me that evening. One almost take me to jail. The other one's saying, no, his neck's all jacked up. We got an MRI. We think he messed his spine up. He's not going anywhere. He's staying in the hospital tonight. And I just remember rolling down the hospital. It was kind of a ceiling like this. And I just seeing those lights pass by and those ceiling tiles pass by and coming in and out of consciousness. And I just thought, if I'm going to die, this is a good time to do it. It had been too much. I lost friends, man. There was fentanyl inside of stuff, extracurriculars and stuff. I mean, it was a rough life. The constant incarceration, the drugs, the alcohol, it all culminated in this one beautiful thing where I just said, you know what? I give up. I just kind of gave up in that hospital bed. And then I came to, and the police had taken the handcuffs off and left me in the custody of the doctors. And when the doctors weren't looking and the police weren't looking, I got up out of the hospital bed. I pulled my IV out, ripped the EKGs off. I had soiled myself in the bed. I was naked. wrapped myself with the bed from with the sheet from the hospital bed and ran out of that hospital. I don't know how this happened. There was a buddy of mine in the hospital because his brother had got shot twice that night in something that went bad in Ocean View. And I said, John, you got a car outside? He said, yeah, Cheyenne's in the parking lot. I said, okay, I'm coming. And I got in the car with them and they drove me home. And when I was in my kitchen that night, there was a bottle of Kentucky Gentleman halfway done in the freezer. And I took it out of the freezer. The suction cups from the EKG still on me. Blood dripping from my head, the hole from the IV in my arm. And I drank the rest of that bottle that night. My car accident happened January 20th. I put my sobriety date January 21st. It probably should be January 22nd because I'm not sure when I finished that bottle that evening. January 21st to February 15th. I know I can't drink anymore. I absolutely know that because I've been through this. The judge is going to want me to do stuff. I got to get the signatures on the thing. If I'm proactive about it and I get the signatures before my court date, he'll think I'm accountable. I'm smart. Got this all figured out. I've been down this road before, so I know what I got to do. But I'm standing on the porch and I'm smoking and I'm shaking and I'm smoking. And I can't, like, I want to drink still, but I know I can't. The police got my, it's all messed up. I'm looking out the mini blinds and sleeping on the floor because I know they're coming to get me and they probably got more charges coming. I don't know if that other guy's alive or dead. I'm freaking out, but I know I can't drink. And it's the worst time of my life. The big book talks about the jumping off place. When we reach a point where we know we can't drink anymore, we can't picture life with alcohol or without it, and we'll know loneliness as few do, and we will reach that jumping off point. That's where I was at between January 21st and February 15th. I wanted to end my own life. I should have been in a detox when I look back at it, really. I got on my hands and knees. I put my face into my recliner in the living room. I don't know God. I don't know nothing about that. I had a God of my childhood, but I don't know God at this point in my life. I'm mad. I'm indignant about all the things that happened in my life. And I just beg and plead. I say, I don't know who's up there or if anybody can hear me. The universe, Buddha, Krishna, the elephant with the eight arms. I don't know who's listening. But I need help. I really need help. And I swear to y'all, it was like, I remembered those people from AA when I got them five signatures back in 2010. And I said, I wonder if those people are still out there. So I got out my phone, I Googled Alcoholics Anonymous. And it gave me the hotline number. And so I called the number and I was like, where's the meeting at? They said, oh, on First View, there's a scout house behind Holy Trinity, St. Pius, I think it's Holy Trinity. There's a scout house back there, there's a meeting. I go over there, I'm walking through, I can't find it. I call the number back, they're saying, oh, we're sorry, we thought that was Tuesday, it's Wednesday. Do you know where Bayview Boulevard's at? I said, yeah, my parents live off Bayview Boulevard. The bar that I used to drink at, a place called Pizza Chef, is on Bayview Boulevard. Right next to Pizza Chef, there's Christ United Methodist Church. And I walk through the doors, and there was a guy who got a meeting list and they passed it around and everybody put their numbers on it and they wrote, keep coming back. And then he comes up to me after the meeting's over with and he hands me this piece of paper and he's like, here's my number. Here's everybody's number. You can call us. I got a white chip that evening. I don't really remember much of it, but I've heard all the guys in my home group tell me about this. Apparently, I don't know, it had to be God. I said the prayers, I was lost. I went walking around looking for a meeting, I called the number, I walked through that door. The guy who did the meeting list ended up becoming my sponsor. He's still my sponsor, I've only ever had one. That first meeting that I went to ended up being my home group, it's still my home group. It worked out the way it was supposed to work out. It was perfect. I couldn't have wrote it down any better. He says, here's a book, and then, so this is Wednesday at 7. Sunday, that group meets at 5:30. Sunday at like 4:30, my phone rings. It was him. He's like, hey man, you're coming down Sunday, right? Yeah, I'll come. I go again, and they're outside and they're talking, and everybody seems happy and everybody's talking. And I hear this one guy saying he just did a year for a hit and run and everything. So I'm like, oh, I gotta figure out what this guy knows, because I'm probably getting ready to do some time too, so I'm going to know this guy, and he's sharing his experience, strength, and hope. I didn't know any of that at the time. I thought I was, like, siphoning information off of him. And, you know, those guys, they spoke my language. They knew what I had been through. The magistrate told me, she said, "Sir, you've been incarcerated 7 times in your adult life, and you were completely inebriated every time upon arrival. Do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" The magistrate can, you know, go somewhere with that mess. The lawyer says the same thing. "Jeff, I'm tired of representing you like this. You're drunk all the time, and you're constantly doing this stuff, whether it's a felony or just a small misdemeanor. Every time you do this, every time you call me, I know you was drinking." The police, my mom, every girlfriend I ever had, everybody, they all say, "Jeff, you got problems drinking." I didn't want to hear none of that from them. These guys spoke the same language I did. They knew what I had been through because they had been through it too. And I could sense that immediately. I hadn't read a big book. I hadn't known any of that stuff. I just knew that these guys were my people. I could listen to them and trust them. They start carrying me around to meetings. And my sponsor's wife is in the program too. Some of y'all know who I'm talking about. She tells me that AAs have been known to go to court and testify for one another. So I'm thinking, like, okay, I don't know about sponsors, I don't know about sobriety or none of that, but if I can weasel these people into going down to the court and testifying for me, that'll work nicely. So so he's like, I'll help you out however I can as long as you keep coming back and read this book with me and work these steps. Okay, we'll do whatever step you want to do as long as you're going to come to court and we're signing this paper because the judge is going to lock me up forever. And I remember being here. Y'all asked the Ocean View speakers meeting. I think Steve did. He came and asked them to speak, and it was my sponsor's wife. Y'all know Bob Hickey. It was a couple guys from Ocean View. They come over here. So my sponsor, every Friday night for 6 months, he would pick me up and take me to meetings. We went all the way to Richmond to go to a speaker meeting one time. We went every single meeting in Hampton Roads that is offered on a Friday night. Every single Friday night for 6 months, that guy came and picked me up. And he sat, my group meets at 7, he come and he said, "Meet me at 6. And every single Wednesday, he would meet me at 6 and we would read through that book. And we did weird things. We read together, we held hands, we said prayers. I got to get this guy to be my sponsor because he's going to testify for me. He's got these tattoos in his beard. I think he's like some hardcore dude, right? He's like, "Hold my hand and say a prayer." But I wasn't going to jail. I wasn't drinking. It started to work immediately. I was all over every one of those pages of that book. That Bill guy, every single piece of it. The two employers. I hated all my jobs. It was just, I was in that book. They wrote my story. I swear Bill wrote it about me. And then we do this inventory thing. And he says, "You got to write this inventory." And I'm reading the book and I'm trying to do it. And I can't figure it out for like 2 months. I go to Thalia Lynn Baptist Church. And this lady named Ursula is putting on a 4-step workshop. So, and I write it. And then I get the gist of what's happening here. So I write it all down, and I come to my sponsor with this pile of stuff, my whole life story. And that's got nothing to do with my alcoholism. We talk about resentments, we sit there. This is an important part. When I had my 4-step, there's a Saturday morning group in Ocean View that meets at 8:30. He came to that meeting, and after the meeting was over with, he was like, "Do you have your 4-step?" Because I carried a backpack with me that had all my sheets in it and everything. I had a notebook. People say do 90 and 90. I went to 443 meetings in a row before I stopped taking inventory in that notebook that I was carrying with me. I had the 4-step. He invited me to his house. This is the first time. He's been my sponsor for like 6 months now. He invited me to his house. I find out he lives a block away from me. My front yard, my corner, is a bus stop. Two of the kids at that bus stop that are waking me up every morning or his kids. My sponsor's kids are in my street, and he lives right there. So I walk to his house. I'm like, "Oh, man, you've been here the whole time." Again, God doing for me what I can't do for myself, because why does my sponsor live a block away, and he's been there the whole time? You're telling me he's been there the whole time? They've been sober, and I was over here drunk forever the whole time? When I do that 5th step, a lot of people know a lot about my story. A lot of people know a lot of things in my life. I've never sat down and told somebody the whole thing. It took us like 3.5, almost 4 hours to do it. It was a June I think it was June. And it was one of them days where the rain had come down so hard, but it was so hot that the steam was coming back out the blacktop. And I got up from that picnic table. He gave me a hug. He told me, go home, take an hour to yourself and sit down and reflect on what we've done. We read the paragraph. If you're making bricks without the mortar and mortar without the sand and you're building the archway through, you're going to walk. And I think it's the bottom of 71. It tells you what to do after the fifth step. Go home and take that hour. It's so important. Because when I walked away from that table and I started walking home, immediately, the bright light, the educational variety and the bright light that people talk about and how you can, the fifth step says, I didn't bring my big book with me because it's in here. The fifth step says that you will feel the nearness nearness of your Creator, and you'll begin to walk hand in hand with God, and you'll trudge the road of happy destiny. That's where that was at, right? It said the fifth step. When I walked home from his house that day after doing my fifth step, I trudged that happy road of destiny, and I knew I didn't have to drink. I knew I didn't have to drink anymore. That fifth step was really what set me free. The first time I was ever honest with another human being and God at the same time. By this time, the court case was over with. The other driver was driving without a license, was speeding, and was smoking pot behind the wheel. Neither one of us should have been on the road that night. They didn't press any further criminal charges. And everybody says, well, now that Jeff's... I got the breathalyzer in the car with the camera attached to it. But everybody's saying, now that Jeff's out of the hot water, he's going to go back to drinking. And I was like, I don't think I am. I kept coming back. I just kept going back. I did 6 and 7. I wrote a list for 8. When 9 came around, I was like, I was at work one day and my boss was walking by and he was on the list, and I just, this willingness that we talk about in step 8, I just had acquired that willingness. And I walked over to him and asked him for a moment of his time in his office and just told him how I'd been a terrible employee and probably should have waited a little bit on those amends, because I didn't really know what I was making amends for. I was just saying I'm sorry and crying like a little baby. But again, you know, the fifth step when I talked to another person, the ninth step when I brought my sobriety to another person, and I just kept it inside and between me and God in my notebook, but when I brought it out, shared it with the world, I started to get free. It got good to me. I ran around making amends to everybody that was on that list. I was scratching off names left and right. I was going to all my old employers and paying back. I stole from you. Here's $400. I was crazy, but it was doing it, and I wasn't drinking. I got sober, say, January, so it was 12-step program, 12 months. I had myself on a schedule. I was doing a step a month. I made all the amends I could. I couldn't find everybody that was on that list. I was told to leave some of the exes alone. They'll present themselves whenever they come. Tenth month comes around. The tenth step, you know, it's daily maintenance. I'm doing upon awakening. These things are working. I'm saying my prayers. I'm waking up early in the morning, giving myself extra time. Maybe everybody on the road, maybe they do know how to drive. Maybe if I'm giving myself 15 minutes to get to a place that takes 20 minutes to get, maybe it's not their problem, maybe it's mine. I'm learning that a lot of my problems in life are my own making, and if I just change a few things about myself, I don't have to be so upset. And this is coming through 10 and 11, I'm saying prayers. 12 comes around. What do you got to do in 12? You got to carry the message. This guy, Bill, I don't know if Bill knows he's the one that gave me my white chip back in 2010, but Bill comes up to me and says, there's a newcomer, and then there's me. And I'm almost a year at this point. Bill says, you should help that guy. He like hands me my first sponsee. So now I'm like a year sober and I'm sponsoring a guy. And I sat in this chair at the Ocean View 12 and 12 meeting Thursday night. I sat in that chair and chaired that meeting for a year. And all of a sudden I wasn't drunk and I didn't want to drink. They say hang around until the miracle happens. They say, you know, just keep coming back. I kept coming back and hung around long enough for the miracle to happen, because one day I didn't want to drink. I used to get off the interstate and my car would want to just drive to the liquor store. I used to walk into 7-Eleven and my feet would go to the beer cooler. And I'd be like, what am I doing back here? I used to be scared of the food line because there was a beer aisle. The Ocean View Fishing Pier is my favorite place in the world. But when you go there, everybody's drinking. I went there my first year sober and I was freaked out at how many people were going to get a DUI tonight. They're all drinking. This is horrible. They should bring prohibition back. I hate alcohol. Second year I went back and I was like, oh, you know, everybody's drinking, but it's not my place. The third year I went back and I realized I was fishing one day and I realized I had been out there all summer and it didn't even bother me whether they were or they weren't. It was completely placed in a sense of neutrality. The 10th step promises. We read the 9th step promises in the meetings. I didn't come in here for fear of financial insecurity and fear of people, places, and things. I came here because I wanted to stop drinking. The 10th step promises speak directly to that. It says you're going to recoil from it as if a hot flame. You're going to be placed in neutrality. You will see that it just happened. It come with no effort. You cease fighting anyone or anything, especially alcohol. That happened to me. One day I didn't drink no more. The people that did drink didn't bother me. My sobriety wasn't everybody else's business. I can't drink. That's all I need to know. So I'm sober at that point. And 2 years into sobriety, I'll tell y'all this one. My grandma died. I went to West Virginia to go to her funeral. And all my cousins was drinking. I'm far away from my home group. I'm far away from all my peers and everything that kept me sober that I thought kept me sober. And I was in the Walmart in Bluefield, West Virginia. And I was standing by the beer and I was looking at the wine and everything and I was so far away. And for a second, my brain said, you know what? You're so far away. Nobody will know. Your grandma's dead. All your cousins are drinking. I let myself go there for a minute. And then I just started praying right there in the Walmart and I walked away from it. And I was like, oh, that's the higher power thing. No human power can relieve this. An alcoholic at certain times has no mental defense against the first drink. It must come from a higher power. And I understood that then because it was God that took me away from that drink that day. So I went to a meeting because AA is everywhere. I come back home. My mom calls me one day. She's in Sentara Lee Hospital. She says, Jeff, your brother's been hospitalized. My brother's 5 years younger than me. I'm 41 at the point. He's 36 years old. I go to the hospital, he's swollen up, legs are big, he's yellow. My little brother got stage 3 cirrhosis of the liver and alcoholic hepatitis. He's laying in the hospital bed dying. I'm going in treatment committees. I'm sitting in rehabs carrying this message. I've dedicated my life to helping other alcoholics. And there's my little brother, the guy that I want to help more than anything, laying there dying from this disease. And it just, you know, I see alcoholism for what it is. It's bad. And at this time, I'm sponsoring a young man who had a DUI through the military. And he don't want to drink. And he's written his inventory. He's about 6 months sober at this point. And he's written his inventory. And he calls me on the phone and he says, Jeff, I'm ready to do the 5th step. So I leave the hospital where my brother's laying there with cirrhosis and hepatitis, and I go to hear this man's 5th step. And I'm clear as day. I tell y'all that this program works and that the 12 steps will grant you a spiritual experience that will, if done thoroughly and honestly, will eliminate this problem. It has for me, and I've seen it work for other people. My brother's laying there. He calls me high horse, high and mighty. I'm a little baby girl because I had to have God get me to stop drinking. There he is dying. Here's this other young man who's taking this thing seriously, and me and him sit and do a 5th step, and he's getting set free. He calls me the next day. He says, Jeff, I feel so much lighter now that I've told somebody else all that, and I feel so good. So, you know, I see it. I see sobriety and alcoholism, and I see a clear path between the two. And I know that everything in that big book is true because I've lived it. I've seen it, and I've seen it take people out, and I've seen it save people's lives. And I've only been doing this for 2.5 years, but I have had the kind of experiences that let me know that I'm in the right place and that this program actually works. My brother did not pass away. He's still very sick. They say somewhere within 1 to 5 years he's probably going to have a transplant. I'm not sure if he's drinking right now. He doesn't really talk to the family anymore. My parents both still drink. My mom was drunk the night my brother came home from the hospital. It's hard being an alcoholic from a family of alcoholics that aren't treated. I probably should pop my head in an Al-Anon meeting every once in a while. But I've made my home here, and it's kept me from having to have a drink since the day I walked in. And I'm telling y'all, when I went in that hospital bed that night, I gave up. I think I did my first step in that hospital bed. When the police and the doctors are fighting over who's going to get custody of you, it's pretty unmanageable. When you go home and finish the bottle after leaving the hospital AMA and evading police custody, it's pretty much powerless over alcohol. I had the first step in the bag as soon as I walked through the door. Today, I go in meetings and I don't feel the need to chair and share because I see people that got 6 months of sobriety and they're sharing and they're handing out the chips. And I believe in a system of rotating leadership. I don't get all preachy on y'all. AA, police is not a service position. I wish people would study their traditions more. Sometimes we go a little bit far outside issues and things, and I think it could probably scare off some newcomers, and everybody deserves a chance at sobriety. The greatest thing that happened, the greatest thing that happened in my sobriety is just now coming to fruition. I've been going back to church. I did not have a relationship with God. I was raised in a Baptist church. It was fire and brimstone. I didn't have a relationship with God. Now I do. I go to church now. I'm working on finding what it is. I'm not sure what church is going to be my home or where I'm going to land. People say AA, God led them to AA and AA led them to God. I think my idea of a higher power is evolving. And the most important thing, man, is I'm not drinking. And if it worked for me, it could work for anybody. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Jeff.